Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to Mountain Comics. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. And joining me in the cabin for this season premiere episode is my pal and fellow podcaster, Chuck Dill. Hi, Chuck.
Good evening, Rob. Good to hear you.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. You've been on a couple of my shows before. We've always had delightful conversations. And so thank you very much for coming to the cabin, joining me in the cabin for this, as I said, season premiere episode of Mountain Comics.
It's my pleasure. I always listen to Mountain Comics. It always puts a big old stupid grin on my face. I love hearing the childhood memories of other comic book fans.
Oh, man. Well, this episode is going to be chock-a-block with that. We're here, as you know, you saw the show notes, we're here to talk about All-Star Squadron Annual Number One. All-Star Squadron, a beloved book to many, a comic fan of our, let's say, vintage, let's use that term. Not only was the series beloved, but this particular issue is really great. And again, we're going to get into all the details of it. Before we even get to all that, you know, Chuck, you haven't been on the show before, so I have to ask you, do you have anything like Mountain Comics in your past? Did you go on vacations where you got comics? Is this anything familiar to you?
We didn't go on vacations per se. What we did was moved. So my father was in the Air Force.
Oh, wow.
And every time we moved, we would make a meal out of it, taking a road trip. And they would buy enough comics for me just to keep me quiet and out of their hair. You could kill a horse by stuffing all the comics down there. So, the first one was from Texas to upstate New York, and that was summer of 1977. So many comics, including an issue of Aquaman. I didn't even know he had his own thing, and it was the first issue of the revived book.
Mm-hmm. November 57. Yeah,
but shortly before the book that we're about to talk today, we moved from Montgomery, Alabama, to Fairfax, Virginia.
These are big moves, man. These are culturally and geographically big moves.
Never took a plane, always drove. It was kind of mind-numbing. So, yeah, and this was when I was actually buying comics myself, which did not happen until 1982, the back half of sixth grade. I finally started earning allowance and lawn mowing money to the point where I could actually buy comics myself. And All-Star Squadron was very new to me.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't heard of that book. But when I bought it, I hesitated a while at the comic rack, but it had Hawkman on it. So my first issue was number 10. And I love Hawkman, and I love the Earth 2 concept. So I went ahead and bought it and memorized it and studied the hell out of it and made little notes during math class in sixth grade. Was making notes about All-Star Squadron and drawing pictures. But for me, it was the fourth quarter of the DC Universe. Four major quadrants, Justice League, Teen Titans, Legion of Superheroes, and the All-Star Squadron.
You like your team books?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a problem thinking about why would you ever buy a book with one superhero? It's not enough bang for your buck.
On these trips that you would take, I'm curious, would your parents buy you a stack of books and that was expected to last you the entire trip? Or would they replenish them if you tore through them? You know, you're going from Texas to New York. By the time you got to, say, you know, Ohio, and you're like, hey, I'm out of comics, would they buy you more? Or was it kind of, here's 50 comics, they reread them if you finish them, start over?
My father was very militant about keeping us moving and keeping us on the road going. So that first trip in 77, I know that she had a full bag at her feet, like brown paper bag filled with comics and then crosswords or whatever junk for my sister. But I think she filled it full of three packs, the Whitman three pack.
All those bags torn open. No.
Right. You'd occasionally get your Richie Rich or your Archie and Donald Duck, but you know, then you'd have Superman and Green Lantern, Green Arrow, and Amazing Spider-Man. So yeah, but the comics reduced. Like for every trip, they got less and less generous with how many comics we packed.
Okay.
So we moved from New Hampshire to Alabama. I think I only had two comics and two digests.
That's it for that trip?
Yeah.
Wow.
I read the crap out of them. That's the DC Digest with the reprinting of JLA 100, 101, and 102.
Ah, that's a good one. Yeah.
And I think I mentioned to you before, I pretty much got that one memorized.
That's three teams. So that's a good, good value. So there you go. Yeah. Okay. Wow. So can you remember when you saw All-Star Squadron? Did you know what it was before you saw it? Or was it like, hey, what is the, oh, what the hell's All-Star Squadron? Oh, Hawkman. Or were you familiar with it? And you were like, oh, finally, this is, I know what this is.
No, I did not know. There were a lot of things I did not know. I considered myself to be the comic book guy, and everybody in our class also considered me to be that. But looking back, I'm like, God, there was so much I didn't know. I didn't know about the new Teen Titans until I finally picked up an issue there at the same little card shop. I found the All-Star Squadron number 10. So it was those four books. And then that was also when John Byrne was on Fantastic Four. So I'd always loved the FF. Yeah. Thanks.
Great to, stuff. Great stuff.
Yeah. A Treasury comic I had with the FF when I was a kid. So I was always looking to pick up FFs. And yeah, I remember passing up the Galactus cover with the FF and the Avengers all around Galactus, the white background. I passed that up so I could get one of my other regular books. And next time we went, it wasn't on the stands. I should have bought that.
And so I remember those choices, those Sophie's choices of having to decide, mm-hmm. you know, do I mm-hmm. want this or that? Or then this book is $1, but this, you know, I could get two for 50, you know, two books at 50 cents, but this one's $1, you know, there was all of this, unless, you know, your parents are super generous. And sometimes mine weren't, sometimes they weren't. I really had to make those bargains, and that was hard. Kid, modern comics fans will never understand.
So I pick up All-Star Squadron 10 and I get home and I don't really know anything about it. I've not even seen a house ad. I know that it's Earth 2 characters. The first page is a big shot of Starman, and I was familiar with him. But the blurb at the top of the page talked about 1942, a world at war. So I was like, well, wait, is Earth 2 40 years past what Earth 1 is currently? Like, I had that confusion, not knowing that this was a book in, that took place in the past, and it took me a while to ramp up. And there are two pages in there that talk about the Nazis making a push into Russia. And it talks about how they're getting beat back by General Winter. And it's just an off-the-cuff remark that Roy Thomas made, just referring to harsh Russian winters. And I'm all like, is General Winter a member of the All-Star Squadron? I've never heard of him. So, yeah, he went on my list for quite a while, that General Winter was a Russian hero.
Where's his who's who listing? Now, so once you got it, was it a regular buy? Did you find it regularly at that point?
Absolutely. I mean, the Jerry Ordway artwork. Mm-hmm. And then from there, where the book was going with the Ultra Humanite and the Justice Society. And yeah, it was the fourth pillar. It was a constant.
It was a wonderful book. I never missed it. Once I got, I think I bought it. It's one of the few books I can remember buying from first to last. You know, I bought every one and every issue until it ended. That there aren't that many books that I can say that about. But but absolutely, that was one of them. So yeah, when you wanted to talk about this one, I was especially excited because I, you know, we'll get into the synopsis of this book in a moment. But I remember, I mean, you know, I've talked on the show about the various stores that we frequented for me to get comics. And the town, the nearest town from where our cabin was a one road town called Hawley. That, you know, very Mayberry like. It was just there's the main drag and there was basically nothing else. And but it had like four newsstands because this was the 70s and 80s. And that's where I would get my comics. But once in a while, my parents would take a day trip to like another hour outside of the town into deeper Pennsylvania. And we went to, quote unquote, the bigger town, which was called Honesdale, Pennsylvania. And Honesdale was what most people that live in suburbs would consider a small town. But compared to Hawley, it was big because it had multiple streets and it was just overall bigger. So, of course, I'm very excited because I'm thinking, well, if there are like four newsstands in Hawley, this is going to be that many, at least in Honesdale. Right. And they take me to this place and it was a barber shop with a newsstand attached, which is, you know, they don't exist anymore. And I remembered looking through the glass of the shop and right in the front was these racks of comics. And it, because Honesdale was a bigger town, the store had more, like the store had a lot of, I mean, carried magazines, not just comics. And I remembered, it's funny, the stuff you remember, you know what I mean? Like I'm in my 50s now and memories fade and there are women I've dated whose last names I can't remember, but I can still remember this where I took three steps up to go into the place. It was slightly raised and I opened the door and there was a bell, you know, it jingled and there's the barber and he's cutting somebody's hair and he looks at me as a little kid. And I remembered seeing this cover, this gorgeous, and of course you'll get to see it in the gallery post accompanying this episode, this gorgeous, incredibly colorful cover by Jerry Ordway featuring this magenta colored being fighting off six members of the All-Star Squadron. And I grabbed it and was like, even though it was $1 or $1.50 or whatever it cost, it immediately went in the pile because I bought All-Star Squadron. I don't think I knew there was an annual out yet, or maybe if I had, I hadn't seen it, but I just no copy. Right? No cover copy on this thing at all. Just the image drawn by Jerry Ordway with this bright green background and the magenta logo, the magenta DC bullet. I mean, it is just so wonderfully garish. And I just absolutely love it. And I was so excited. And I ran home and read this thing. And it's always been, look, I've always loved All-Star Squadron, but this always remains one of my favorites. Now, so before we get again to the plot synopsis, why did you pick this one? Why did you want to talk about this particular comic?
I kind of have a big story about this one, so you're going to have to forgive me if I go on a little bit.
That's what the show is all about, Chuck.
I already talked about how we moved from Mobile, Montgomery, Alabama, to Fairfax, Virginia, which, if you're not familiar, is a major suburb of D.C., lots of military and government people there. It's kind of fancy now. A lot of people were there. And I was going to be starting seventh grade. The high school, Robinson High School, is the largest in the state. It's huge. My graduating class was 1,010. And the high school was 7th through 12th. And I was starting seventh grade, and this place was like a small city. It was just huge. And this idea of having to move between classes every hour was freaking me out and not knowing anybody. And could I make any friends? And maybe I'll be lucky enough to make a friend that was in more than one of my class, which never happened at Robinson. It was just a lot of stuff going on. So again, and I've mentioned this before on your podcast, but this further cements my love of comic books. It's the only, constant that I had in my life, the only real friend at the time. But I did not know what annuals were. And at the time, we got All-Star Squadron Annual 1 here, but DC was just getting back into the annual game.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked up an issue of Legion of Superheroes, issue number 290, the first issue of the Great Darkness Saga. And there's this new guy in it, Invisible Kid. I'm like, where the heck did he come from? And I went back to my comics to see if I'd missed an issue. And I hadn't over the last 8 months. So where did he come from? And I found a little editorial note that he was from the Legion of Superheroes annual number 1. Never saw it on the stands. I was lucky enough to find the new Teen Titans annual number 1 at a magazine stand in a drugstore in Virginia, which that's the capper to the whole Tamaran saga with Blackfire. That you know, missing that would have been a punch in the face. But I found it. But I never saw the All-Star Squadron annual, never knew it existed. So I tromp off to school. I was sick to my stomach. I threw up that morning, but nevertheless, still went to school. First day of seventh grade, and I'm slogging my way through these classes, and I am miserable. I'm uncomfortable. I'm outside my routine. I don't know anybody. I'm a geek. The whole deal. So we're sitting in English class. And the teacher gets the idea. She wants to go around the room, and everyone tells what their father does for a living.
Okay, oh God, okay.
You gotta tell your name and something about you, and then what your dad does. So I sit through this, and we finally get to me, and I say my father is an Air Force fighter pilot. Yeah, and that gets, you know, a little bit of attention, but, you know, not much. And then I shut up. And then the guy next to me starts talking and says his father does comic books. His father is famous for drawing the Incredible Hulk.
Huh.
And that is how I became best friends with Tony Buscema, the middle son of Sal Buscema.
What? Did you mention comics in your talk?
I did not. But as Tony was to tell this story, he's very familiar with going through this, and he had a bunch of celebrity because his father had this Incredible Hulk thing. But I don't think he ever met a comic book fan as big as me. And he said he slowly turned and realized the look I was giving him, like I was going to eat him alive. But yeah, Tony and I became best friends. Poor Tony. I was a huge geek, but I would not leave him alone. I would not let it drop. We were going to be friends no matter what. And at the time, I wanted to be a comic book artist, which is not something that ended up happening.
I think you're better off.
My mother kept mentioning how, you know, those guys are dirt poor. They don't make any money. So went to visit Tony one day. My mother drove me, and we had an English assignment that we were going to work on together. So we got to go to Tony's house. He lived in the better part. We lived in a pretty good area, and there was an area better than where we lived. And that's where we drove to a residential. It wasn't gated off, but it might as well have been. Huge house, pool in the back. My mother was a little gobsmacked about all this. So I hung out with Tony Buscema and met Sal Buscema, and there was Tony's birthday party, and Sal came in and said, as a surprise for everyone, he was going to draw a picture of each of us. And then we could pick some comics. He had the comp copies.
Oh, wow.
So they picked me first because I was freaking out. Just to shut me up, they you know, so the other guys could have some fun. They wanted to take me off the board. So Sal brought me back and got a wonderful picture of me. I wish I still had it. And he drew in pencil. And he had the stacks of comics on the floor right there in his studio up against the wall in front of his drawing board. He says, pick what you want. And I got All-Star Squadron Annual number one. I also got a, what was it, Blue Ribbon Digest number 19, a George Perez cover with the Doom Patrol. And I only knew the Doom Patrol because Changeling had mentioned them in his Tales of the Teen Titans issue. I wasn't familiar with the X-Men. I was able to pick up a couple of issues of X-Men, and including some famous ones with the Sentinels attack Jean and the team. I think it was 98 or 99. So yeah, it was pretty great. And Tony and I continued to be friends all through 7th through 12th grade. I went off to college for a couple of years. I came back. We rekindled our friendship. And we were gold. And then one day in the early 90s, my fiance dumped me. And a week later, Tony's car was out in front of her house.
Oh, my God. That was, I did not expect that that's where the story was going, Chuck.
They are currently married and have a few kids, but I don't see them much anymore. I haven't talked to them in quite a while.
Oh my! Oh no, Chuck! I mean, you're married now, and you have a family, so it's not like you're sitting there, you know, bitterly still looking through their window or something, waving your All-Star Squadron Annual number one in your fist. But still, that's I'm sorry. I mean, that's like a terrible. I mean, it's a terrible. That's a great story that takes a hard turn, man.
We were great friends in the early 90s. He was one of the candidates for my best man. We would take a day off work and go down to see the Star Trek exhibit at the National Air and Space Museum or stuff like that. We did all kinds of things. And I helped. Sal would go to local conventions and they would bring me with them. And, you know, it was kind of nice.
I'm guessing by the fact that you were willing to even tell this story on the show, it tells me that your experiences with his dad and all that stuff were not we're not ruined by that experience. Like that was that was still great meeting Sal and everything else. So,
great memories of it. Standing in his kitchen while he talked to me about how much he hated DC. As a kid.
Okay. All right. I was like, wait, why did he hate DC? Okay.
His brother John and he would never read DC. DC was the most boring stuff and that and that. And then he said we would even read EC. And I didn't know what EC was at the time. Mm-hmm. I was like, did you say DC? No, I didn't say DC.
So why did he have All-Star Squadron then? I mean, how did he have, did they send him those books anyway?
Yes, he had many stacks of Marvel, and he had one solitary stack of DC.
Huh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That is, that is an amazing story.
That's also how I met Walton Louise Simonson.
Wow. Through Sal?
They came over to have dinner with Sal and his wife once. And Tony and I were just happened to be downstairs. He was learning the guitar, so he was playing Stairway to Heaven for me. Wow. He still plays guitar. But yeah, they came down to say hi to Tony and whatever. And there's Walt and Louise Simonson. And Sal is having to introduce me and tell me who they were, because I didn't know my creators backwards and forwards or anything like that. So they told me what they were up to, which I thought was very silly. They were bringing back the original X-Men together.
And, what are you talking about? She's dead. That can't be possible. What are you
right, doing? Right. And they were going to beef up some of their powers because, you know, the original X-Men, they don't have great power levels. So we're going to do this to Beast, and we're going to change Angel, and we're going to give him metal wings that shoot blades. And I'm nodding and grinning and thinking in my head, that is the stupidest thing I've ever.
That's never going to fly. That's never going to work. I don't know. what you two were thinking.
Yeah, wow. But yeah, turns out I was wrong.
Wow. I mean, I'll tell you, everybody, Chuck told me when he picked this book that he had a story, and I was like, well, just share it on the air. I don't want to hear it. But that was more involved and took a darker turn than I expected, I have to say. Wow. Now, is the copy that you have still the same book?
Yep. It might have. I haven't looked at it in a while, but it might have a stamp on it that says not for resale.
Wow.
A lot of the books that I got from him. I got a copy of Wolverine number one that was stamped not for resale.
Oh my God. That is amazing. That's absolutely amazing. That, you did not disappoint with that one, Chuck. You really did not. I really was not expecting that story. Wow.
It's a plot twist. It's all happy memories. It's nothing dark to it. It's all history, but yeah, I still kind of miss him. We
it's funny. You didn't mention her. You mentioned Tony. That's interesting. Okay.
No, but yeah, he was the middle child. And so I got to know his other brothers as well, pretty well. So yeah, they were all good guys.
That's unreal. That is just an unreal story, Chuck. Thank you so much for sharing that. Oh my goodness. Wow. I feel like the comic's going to feel a little bit anticlimactic after this, but okay. We will do our best to talk about All-Star Squadron Annual number one. It was on sale August 5th, 1982. The story is called The Three Faces of Evil, of course, by Roy Thomas, and the pencils and inks are by Adrian Gonzalez and Jerry Ordway. Now, again, once again, keep pushing back the synopsis. What do you think of the cover? What do you think of this as an image?
Well, I love it. I immediately, whenever I see a group cover, I do the roll call and the count in my head. So I break it down. There are three powered all-stars. Four that I was familiar with at the time. I knew of Wildcat, but I wasn't really familiar with him. No idea who Guardian was at the time. This was my introduction to him. So yeah, I had that little spreadsheet aspect when I first saw this cover. But yeah, it's, my wife would call it garish, as she calls many of my t-shirts.
It is garish. Like, it really is. But I think that's what I love about it. It is just so, it's so pure superhero comics of the time. You know, right. I mean, again, you think about, there would have to be cover copy. If this would have been Marvel, there'd be 75 balloons on this thing, you know? And this is just, this, the strength of the illustration alone, and just kind of being like, okay, you know, the our heroes are fighting some giant, mostly naked guy. Here, please pay your $1.50 and you're going to get this. So, okay.
So. Yeah, it does its job of attracting attention.
Mm-hmm. Like I said, I can still picture, I mean, you're talking 1982, right? So you're talking 42 years ago. Yeah. I still have the memory of that store, the creaking of the wood floor and the, you know, like, it's amazing why that was, this one was so powerful in my mind, but it was. Okay. Sorry. We're finally going to get to the synopsis here. Wonder Woman, Flash, and Green Lantern are performing at a circus to raise money for war bonds when suddenly a gleaming white orb appears in the top of the tent. It blinds everyone for a moment, and then our heroes see a bubble containing fellow superheroes, the Atom, Wildcat, and an unknown third man. The three visitors suddenly attack, and the element of surprise allows them to actually land a few blows. Quickly, though, Wonder Woman, Flash, and GL get the situation under control, only to have their attackers wake up out of a stupor, having no memory of what they just did or how they even got there. They collectively decide to get to the bottom of all this and take off. Atom, Wildcat, and the hero we now learn is named Guardian, recall their secret origins and how all of them recently found themselves attacked by a giant glowing orb. Green Lantern uses his ring to probe their minds, and they see that the same man, under two different names, appears in all their lives in a meaningful way. The six heroes split into teams, Green Lantern and Wildcat, Flash and Guardian, Wonder Woman and Atom, to investigate where they might find this mystery man. Each of them do find him, but now he is controlled by some otherworldly power, glowing and containing super strength. Each set of heroes get attacked, but they manage to defeat their foe and bring him back to the now empty circus. This immediately proves to be an unwise idea, for the three unconscious men transform into one being, now a massive giant and even more powerful. So powerful that he manages to fight off Wonder Woman, Flash, and Green Lantern with ease. It's only when Adam, Wildcat, and Guardian attack him at once and remind him of his humanity does he falter and return to human form. As their friend lays there, he explains that after encountering each man and helping them find a path in life, he felt bitter and forgotten. Suddenly, a glowing orb appeared and communicated with him telepathically, explaining that his former three former proteges were now superheroes, and if he surrendered, he would get revenge. Thinking this was all a dream, the man went along with it. The orb then took full control, but the man fought it from the inside. The man explains that the orb was ultimately after Green Lantern for reasons he cannot explain. As the man slowly dies, Green Lantern contains the now separated orb in his power ring and sends it off into deep space for all time. We then flash back many thousands of years to Oa, where the Guardians of the Universe have been confronted with a glowing orb which contains all the evil they have purged from their hearts. The Guardians know such power is too much for anyone, so they decided to banish it to another dimension, a dimension that will contain a champion that will be able to defeat it. Okay, so Chuck, what do you think of this story?
I love it so much. It's so classic. I think Chuck from 40 years ago thought that it was a lot of words. Roy Thomas is famous for, but
wordy. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. You're getting value for your money.
Yeah. It's just got like everything I would want in a superhero story. They split up into smaller teams, Rob. That's freaking awesome. They go through, you get three hero origins in this one and a little kind of, not a splash page, but an action shot with a montage for each new hero, the Atom and Guardian and Wildcat. Then you get the Guardians of the Universe in the end with the nod between Earth 1 and Earth 2. But yeah, Adult Chuck is looking at this splash page that is an homage to Comics Cavalcade number 2 from 1943, and just loving it. I love that Roy felt the need to tip his hat in that direction. Like, you, when reading this book, part of the power is I think you can feel his fandom just right through the pages. Like, maybe Avengers and Invaders and all that was a job to him, but All-Star Squadron was a true love.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mentioned on a bunch of podcasts that I've done that I'm a sucker for anything where superheroes are kind of like pounding around, that I just love. And I love all those comic cavalcade covers of Flash, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern, you know, delivering Christmas presents or doing like a pie fight or whatever it is they were doing. And this splash page is a direct lift of one of them, on the tri-wheeled bike. But I mean, I just love it. I mean, again, it's, you look at this, you know, in contrast to the cover, which I said, you know, has no cover copy, this splash page is already loaded down, right? You've got three faces of evil, exclamation mark, plus presenting. And then a quote from William Shakespeare, for Pete's sakes, Roy Thomas, really super highfalutin. And then you've got word balloons by all of our characters, plus the credit box, plus all this stuff going on in the background, beautifully rendered by Adrian Gonzalez and Jerry Ordway. I mean, not to slight Adrian Gonzalez because he deserves it, but I mean, we all know everyone loves Jerry Ordway. And I think Jerry Ordway on All-Star Squadron is like just perfect, perfect match of style and content. But yes. Man, this, he was such a masterful inker. I mean, he really knew how to bring out the best in somebody's pencils. And I really can't say I'm not familiar with Adrian Gonzalez as a specific artist, but man, Just this splash page alone is so gorgeous. You're just like, oh man, what's going to happen to these three? Is they're goofing off? Like, this is not goofing off. They're trying to raise money for charity, but it's a grabber of an image.
Yeah. As All-Star Squadron went on, and Jerry Ordway ultimately left the book, and I feel like the art suffered in the last few years, and ending up in Young All-Stars, which I just finished a reread of, and it was okay. the art is not great. They're constantly finding new young artists to try out on the book, but there's nothing like this, what we're seeing here.
Yeah, this is just, it was just an amazing find. Again, I can remember Jerry Ordway being the anchor on the, you know, the initial issues drawn by Rich Buckler. Right. And I just, oh God, this book is so gorgeous looking. It's just absolutely so fantastic. So again, you have this initial sequence and then the rope snaps and that's just a normal accident. And the three heroes manage to save themselves in the middle of doing a somersault. You've got shots of the crowd done in this monochromatic style, which looks absolutely beautiful. Then we get the giant orb that blinds everybody and they almost fall to their death, except Wonder Woman uses her lasso to stop her fall. Flash uses his flash powers to kind of lower himself harmlessly to the ground. And then we get the bubble with our three heroes. And again, beautifully rendered. And I love the language, like the visual language of this, of they don't know who Guardian is, but they know who Adam is. They know who they vaguely know Wildcat because this is sort of pre, you know, Wildcat becoming a member of the Justice Society. But I love that the three guys are running at them and there's the panel where Flash and Green Lantern are just like, should we be concerned? They seem to be kind of, ow! And then the punches start flying. And there's this big shot of Wildcat's fist in the panel. It's just, I just love the idea of them like, should we take this into any sort of, I think that's just great.
I mean, time-wise, it was just a couple months ago where Captain Kirk taught us in Star Trek II, always raise those shields.
Exactly. You never know. You never know. And so, again, I love that idea that, you know, that these obviously Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, and Flash are three of the heaviest hitters of the Justice Society. And these other three heroes, all three of which are non-powered, are really not going to be able to get anywhere. But they get the element of surprise for a moment, at least. And that can, you know, and of course, our heroes don't want to hurt their friends because they realize something is up here. And Wonder Woman pastes Adam One, which is great, and then throws him. Which is terrific. But that you can just break him into.
They are souped up. They are souped up by energy. So Guardian is able to at least catch Flash with a punch.
Yep. And then he stops Flash with his shield. Flash runs into his shield and slams into him and stuff. So, and again, just absolutely gorgeously rendered by Gonzalez and Ordway. I mean, just look at this. Like, this is just such a pleasure to look at.
Yes. Every page a treat.
So they decided to, they're like, okay, our heroes wake up and they realize they don't even know what's happened. They decide to take off. Green Lantern flies them all on a magic carpet, complete with table and chairs that look like the Justice Society meeting table, which is just fantastic. And I love the blurb, chapter 2, Secret Origins. And it's the old Secret Origins logo from the 70s DC title, which I thought was such a great touch.
Right. This is more elements of something that I would want everything in a comic book, chapter titles and logos, the whole thing.
Yeah. Beautiful. And so, as you mentioned, we get Secret Origins of our three characters. Now, you mentioned you were not familiar with Guardian. I don't think I was either at this point. Were these origins, if you can remember, were these origins new to you? Did you feel like you were learning about these guys for the first time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. All three of them. Like I said, I had a few Justice Society appearances, and I had that digest, which made me feel like an expert. But Wildcat, he's in the chapter with Green Lantern and Aquaman, and he's obviously a boxer, but that's it. That's all I knew about him.
Okay. And then we get the Guardian Secret Origin. And because Roy is really introducing the Guardian to a whole new audience, he gets a much larger sequence. Like, he gets four full pages of a sequence of his, you know, he talks about his developing his powers, and he's a cop in this sort of rough part of town. And he works as both a superhero kind of at night and, it's, you know, a cop by day. And then they go through that whole bit. And he talks about, he gets taken off by the orb, and then Green Lantern does the mind probe, and we see that there's the same guy across all of them. As you mentioned, this is a very wordy book. Roy Thomas really did. The letterer really earned his keep. There are panels here where there's like one panel on page 20 where Wonder Woman is talking, and I think there's six word balloons in one panel, and it's like, I do have sympathy for Adrian Gonzalez trying to kind of fiddle this in and make it look, you know, kind of cool.
Absolutely. No mention at all of the Newsboy Legion.
No, I guess not.
We get all those pages of Guardian and nothing. But it does start off with him as a kid, him and his friend as a kid, and it's a little Newsboy Legion-y there, but there's no comparison or reference or anything.
So we get a full page from the Atom where he's thinking about maybe they could use some more help, call in some of their other friends. And so we sort of get a where is everybody at this moment? And so we see Firebrand and we see Robot Man, we see Steel, Shining Knight, Liberty Bell, Johnny Quick, and of course Hawkman, because if anyone didn't know, it was Roy Thomas's personal pledge to feature Hawkman in every single issue of All-Star Squadron, even if it was down to a simple head, like on a cover, or a picture of Hawkman in a picture. He appeared in every single issue because I think he was Roy's favorite character. So you must have loved that because you talked about how much you loved Hawkman.
Yeah, I did. I had read maybe issue 10, maybe another issue, but I had read somewhere that Hawkman and the Atom were his top two. They were his favorite. And there was the All-Star Squadron used to do the bio data stuff in the back of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the first time I read about the Atom was in issue 10, I think. And it mentioned that he's the one that has the second most frequent appearances in the original All-Star comics, and that Hawkman was the only one who beat him. So he missed out one issue, but Hawkman was there for it all. But another reason I like this annual was because in my head, the core team was Johnny Quick and Liberty Bell, Firebrand, Steel, and Robot Man. Because they were for like maybe five issues. So I thought that that's where the book was going, that those were going to be the core issues. And this annual didn't focus on any of that. It gave us some mm-hmm. new All-Stars.
And that's fun. That's a fun. I mean, that's a great way to use the annual to give the other characters. Because, I mean, the annuals were not published. I mean, this is obvious for anyone who reads comics, but the annuals weren't published in lieu of a regular issue. They were a bonus. So you got your regular issue of the comic and then you got the annual. So yeah, why not give some space to some other characters? Why not give Wildcat, especially Guardian, some extra space? So why not? So then we get the next chapter, Tragedy in Triplicate. Again, I love they get their, we have chapter titles. That's a long, thing long since passed. Then we, our heroes meet this guy from Guardian's past, except he's now colored magenta and glowing, and Guardian defeats him relatively quickly, and then of course the orb comes in, but then they see something sort of happening to this guy. Same thing happens with Adam and Wonder Woman, except this time this guy is turned kind of metallic looking. There's an absolutely bravura sequence, it's page 25 of the book, where Adam and Wonder Woman double team this guy, and it's all one. It's not a montage. It's a still image, but it's all one sequence. It's not broken down into panels, except for the last where Adam gets him in the stomach and knocks him out. But I like that it's multiple figures across just one panel in a black background. It's just really beautiful,
right? And not crowded. You can tell what's going on. The action in modern comics often throws me. I find it disturbing where I can't really tell what's going on. But here you can tell who's throwing what punch and who landed and who didn't and the whole deal. And I don't think I mentioned Young All-Stars earlier, but this is a power of the artist that we did not have later on in the series.
What? How so?
You couldn't directly tell the action or that it wasn't delineated, or sometimes it was overcrowded, or sometimes there were huge blank spaces in the pages. But this is all very economical, a lot going on. We even have a kind of sort of surprint, to use a word I picked up from a podcast, of Wonder Woman in the background there. But it's not unwelcome. It's just all nicely done.
It really is. Again, it's beautiful. And there's just something about certain artists can really delineate punches well. Some not as others. I've talked about Jim Aparo, my favorite, who every time Batman landed a punch, it looked like it had, you know, the power of a nuclear bomb going off on somebody's face. Adam gets a shot in on this guy's stomach that really looks like it hurts, even though it's just the Adam. It's not Wonder Woman. It really looks like it's like it would just knock the wind out of you. And it's, again, it's beautifully drawn by Gonzalez and Ordway.
Yeah, you and Chris have talked about Sal Buscema's punches.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good Lord. Yeah. Did Sal ever draw you getting punched in the crotch like he drew so many heroes getting? He always had that crotch punch. That was one of his go-tos.
Nope. Joe Staton, I always marveled over the knuckles on his fists. And like they look like they would really hurt, just the knuckles.
So Green Lantern and Wildcat, of course, do the same thing. They go to a boxing ring and they see the guy they're looking for, except he's turned into a gold being. Wildcat knocks him out. They cart them all back to the circus. Now, why they don't bring them back to the, like, JSA headquarters, I don't know. You would think that would be a safer place to take them to, as opposed to a public spot like that. But okay, you know. And then we see that obviously is a mistake, because then they merge into one gigantic being, a sort of white, slightly metallic, but white being. And he gets into like where he's about 20 feet tall. Now, it's kind of funny that on the cover, he's a giant magenta, and here he's not. They decided not to color him that. Maybe making him white for the cover just wasn't as powerful, I guess.
Right. Yeah.
But we get a full page, page 32, of all of our heroes attacking him at once. And again, it's the kind of thing where, I don't know, like, what else do you want out of superhero comics than pages like this?
Yep. And exciting as it comes, you're like, are we going to get a full page shot? And you turn the page and, oh, yep, we did. Yeah. But I love your modesty, Rob. You always skip over some of the details here. I think it's a modesty thing. You do it. In all three cases, the duo defeats the magic colored guy, and then they look shocked that he's changing in the end. Mm-hmm. But the camera cuts away. But we find out later, why are they shocked? What are they seeing? A middle-aged guy in his tidy whities. All
three.
That's
true. Yeah. It's just a guy in his underpants. That's true. Yeah. I wasn't trying to be modest. I guess I just really thought of it. Like, yeah, I guess that is exactly what happened. Yeah.
You know, on the bottom of page 30, we have Green Lantern carrying him down and with an unfortunate angle of the lens.
Yeah, we see he's got his butt in the background. By the way, Jerry Ordway, absolute master at using Zipitone. And this book is full of it, and in the best possible way. I mean, there are certainly ways to overdo it, but he just puts it in little bits and you know, little spots here and there to get shading, like on page 29, where Wildcat is face to face with this guy and the light is coming from in front of the being. So he's darker in the background, and there's like some Zipitone to kind of do there. There's some Zipitone shading on Green Lantern's cape and that panel you're talking about. He just uses it sparingly here and there for really, really nice effect. There's another panel, page 33, where the guy picks up a giant cinder block over his head and he's about to smash Green Lantern with it. And you can see there's like a cinder block shaped Zipitone cut out on the guy's back. And that's totally the inker's job to do. And so Ordway was just really, and he put in special tones on like Guardian's helmet occasionally, on Adam's mask. Like, he just really knew how to use it very effectively.
Yeah, that's awesome. I don't know that much about the artistic end of it, so it's neat to hear you go into detail about it.
Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, Zipitone is just simply a sheet of paper that has different dot patterns attached to it. And it's sticky on one side. And in the old days, you would literally paste it down. Not paste it. You would just apply it to your page and then cut off all the stuff you didn't want. And you would just be left with the part that you did want. And, you know, you could, it had different size dot patterns. Some of them were very fine. Some were a little farther apart. Ordway used it on his covers for All-Star Squadron. He went on to use it on Adventures of Superman and the Power of Shazam. Again, just really one of the masters of it. So anyway, we get the whole explanation as to what happened, that this guy helped all three of our heroes kind of find new lives and felt like he had been left behind, and he was forced into sort of this hardscrabble existence. And so this orb finds him and sort of says, I can, you know, I'll give you revenge if you just submit sort of yourself over to me. The guy is in such a low ebb. He's like, sure, yeah, why not doing it? And that's what splits. He then splits into three beings and tries to get revenge on our hero. And then he slowly passes away on the ground. And as I mentioned in the synopsis, they realize that this creature wanted to go after Green Lantern, but nobody seems to know why. But there's no way of finding out. So Green Lantern uses his power ring to put the orb in a green bubble and sends it off into outer space, presumably forever, where it will just float around and never be seen again. Then we get to what I mentioned, which is our prologue, although it's at the end of the story, where we find out that this is the work of the Guardians of Oa, who distilled all of the evil, all the hatred in their hearts, and then formed into this one being, and they sent it off into deep space, into another dimension, because it basically can't be controlled, because they're like, if we ever, we might succumb to it, so we'll just send it off, and maybe this other champion, if it ever becomes a problem, this champion will be able to deal with it, which circles back to something I've said in other podcasts. The Guardians of Oa are a bunch of dicks. They're just a bunch of dicks. And that we just have example after example of them being like, we are the most powerful beings in the universe. And they do the, excuse my language, they do the dumbest shit possible. And like, I know that I think Roy Thomas probably thought this was like a fun, clever roundabout, you know, way to kind of wind it back to the origin of Green Lantern. And it is, but it just makes the Guardians of Oa look like terrible, terrible idiots. And I, you know, it's just like, I don't remember what my feeling was when I was a kid, but as I've grown up, I'm like, they're awful. They're just awful. And this page just underscores that to me. I don't know. Am I wrong?
No, it's almost as if they're living plot devices.
Mm-hmm.
We need some things to happen. The blue guys were dicks again.
We're going to distill all of our evil in our hearts and send it off into space to another dimension. Because guess what? Now our problem went away. Like, you know, like, what is that about? And again, a lot of it was to circle back and to kind of blend it into the origin of Green Lantern. And that's fine. But it is just like, what? Yeah. You know, and there's even a footnote, see Green Lantern number 40, see Green Lantern number 112, which, of course, at the time, how were you supposed to do that? How, in 1982, how was I supposed to read Green Lantern number 40?
But today you can, but they don't do that for you.
Right. That's the ironic thing. Right. You could do it pretty easily, and now nobody does it. But back then, it's like, see Green Lantern number 40. What, that came out in when? 1966? What am I supposed to do? Like, what are you talking about? You just have to just, you know, like, all right. Okay. I mean, we talked about it. Overall, like, why, how do you feel like this works as an All-Star Squadron story? Did you miss the regulars, or do you feel like it holds up and just has its own piece?
You know, I did not miss the regulars. I was glad that we had the departure, that we focused on the others. I love the Flash, Green Lantern, and Wonder Woman. So despite the fact that it allegedly focused on Wildcat, Adam, and Guardian, there was lots of the comic cavalcade trio going on in here. And I have to point out something we missed on that last page. Two things, actually. They mentioned the 1979 secret origin of Alan Scott.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're pinning ourselves into specific years here.
Yeah, he wasn't worried about that, right? Roy didn't care about that.
No. This was back when we were supposed to believe that Reed and Ben fought in World War II.
Right. Yeah.
But in the first text block of this page, right under the prologue, they refer to the Guardians of Oa as the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Right. Not for copyright purposes, that is not... That's not working anymore. Were they ever called the? I always thought they were called the Guardians of the Universe. Or am I wrong?
Right. Or Guardians of Oa.
Or Guardians of Oa. Right. Like when they appeared on they teamed up with Batman in an issue of Brave and Bold, and I think they're called Guardians of the Universe there. But although that maybe, I don't know. I mean, that's post Guardians of the Galaxy over at Marvel. I mean, obviously it's pre Guardians of the Galaxy becoming as famous as they became, but they introduced that team in the late 60s.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know, but yeah, I've always thought of them as the Guardians of the Universe or Guardians of Oa, but yeah,
But at this point in comics history, nobody knew or cared who the Guardians of the Galaxy were.
No, nobody was talking about Charlie 27 or anything like that. So yeah, it's a really fun story. It's wonderfully self-contained. You know, it's kind of its own thing. It's the multiple chapters, I think, helps keep it moving along. It doesn't feel like it's too long. Sometimes, you know, it's an annual, it could be a longer story. It might feel a little padded, but this really doesn't. And again, part of it is the artwork is just so absolutely top notch. And then on top of that, we get a little bonus feature, which are four All-Star Squadron fact file pages, which are basically proto Who's Who listings. They're written by Roy Thomas, of course, and the art is by Rich Buckler and Jerry Ordway. And we get one on Wonder Woman, one on Flash, one on Green Lantern, and one on Guardian. And the Guardian one is drawn entirely by Jerry Ordway. And it just gives some basic, you know, their origin. It lists the first appearance and things like that. I'm guessing, like me, Chuck, you absolutely ate this stuff up when you got it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because this harkened back to some of the first few issues of All-Star that I got. So, yeah, theories abounding. I think that this Wonder Woman, Flash, Green Lantern, drawn by Buckler, was meant to be all three on the same page like it used to be in those early issues of All-Star. Because there's no background and there's not much detail. Mm-hmm. And then you turn the page for Guardian and it's night and day. That's a poster right there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Ordway's bringing it, right? And you've got his supporting characters. The text is kind of an afterthought. It's kind of just off to the side and stuff. But, man, they're really nice. And that Flash logo is not a logo I'm familiar with. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
Yeah.
The Green Lantern logo is the one from the 40s comic, and the Wonder Woman one is from the 40s comic. The Guardian, I think that was a new logo. I think they designed it for the character. The Flash, I'm not familiar with. But, yeah, pre Who's Who, as a comics nerd, especially a DC comics history nerd, this stuff was great. Like, I could have, you know, I probably was like, oh, I could read a whole book of things like this. You know, this is great. Of seeing this stuff. I love, like, they even do last Golden Age appearance. Like, wow, what a fun detail to go dig out. That was just, I love all this stuff.
Yeah, where else are you going to get it? But that was he probably wrote that with a single tear on his cheek. And he probably from memory, last Golden Age appearance.
That was truly the end of comics, right? Was the final appearance.
I picked up a hardcover back when I didn't have the money to. It was the greatest Golden Age stories ever told. Do you remember?
I remember that. Sure. Yeah. Yep.
And Roy Thomas did the foreword to that. And I was eating that stuff up. I was already loving my comics history. But Roy talked about the moment when he finally got a subscription to All-Star Comics with his precious Justice Society. The first issue that arrived was All-Star Western. And he ends the paragraph saying, and I cried all 10 years worth of me. And that's like a moment I will never forget. I was like, wow, somebody else cares as much about this stuff as I do.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, we didn't realize Roy. Roy took it to a whole other level. But yeah. He probably wrote these things. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I would love to know were these always planned? Was the story, it ended up being four pages short? You know what I mean? Right. I don't know. I don't know whether this was, I mean, obviously the Guardian one was, as you say, because the other ones were drawn by Rich Buckler, who was off the book by this point. I'm assuming that, yeah, they were probably done for a previous issue and then they just didn't use them. And then they realized, oh, we could run them here. And then clearly the Guardian one is done by Orway. But yeah, I love them. They're great. And it's, you know, I mean, you look at this Guardian piece, you're like, this could have been the Who's Who page. It doesn't fit the format without the serpent, but man, you're right. This actually makes Guardian look pretty boss.
Yeah. So Roy wrote in an All-Star Squadron letter column sometime after this that he was going to be showcasing pieces of art from various artists in both Infinity Inc. and All-Star Squadron in the back of the book as he got them. So, and he was editor at the time of both books. So he would commission these from unknown artists, I think, giving them tryouts. So that may be where we got this Ordway piece of him saying, "Hey, you're a fantastic inker. What can you do on your own?" I'm speculating, but we got a lot of pinups in All Star and Infinity Inc. from unknown artists. And shortly after this, they started shortly after this.
What a find, if that was the case. That's the thing about Ordway. I feel like Ordway came fully formed. You know, like you don't see the development. His development was all kind of before he got published. And then once he got published, it was like, God, this guy's awesome. And he just stayed awesome. You know, like it was never, it was just like, oh yeah, the stuff he's doing now is great. The stuff he did then was great. You know, like there was no diminution of skills and no ramp up to the skills. I mean, it depends on your point of view, but you could look at like early Frank Miller and say, okay, I see where he's going. And he comes, you know, he gets the full flower, depending on your point of view, at later Daredevil or The Dark Knight Returns or whatever. But you see in the early days, oh, okay, you know, you look, he drew a Hostess ad for Pete's sakes. You know, you could see the early development of Frank Miller, but Joey Ordway just comes right out of the gate, like, man, this guy's killing it. This guy's just killing it. And it gave All-Star Squadron a distinct look at a really useful time because this is at the time the only Earth 2 book on the stands, so it looked old timey without looking old hat, which was just the perfect style. You want it to look hip and sharp and exciting, but you want it to have a slightly classical look, and that was Ordway to a T.
He had that in spades. So my four pillars of the DC Universe had Ordway on All-Star Squadron and Perez on New Teen Titans and Keith Giffen doing a bang-up job on Legion and Don Heck on Justice League.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, you know, you didn't have to wait too long, and then you got Chuck Patton, so that was good. But yeah,
But
those
you're talking about Ordway being fully formed, but you got Keith Giffen and Barry Windsor-Smith and Bill Sienkiewicz. They all had very classical Neil Adams-ish styles before they finally broke from that and developed their own unique looks. I'll never get over Giffen changing.
yeah, to his Munoz style, yeah. But yeah, I mean, a lot of great stuff. It said this comic is just it's always been on my list of Mountain Comics to cover because it is just the memory of it is so strong. I mean, obviously the memory you had is even stronger, but like the memory I luckily mine isn't attached to anything sad. It was just I got it at Honesdale and loved it and read it a million times, and it's just a great comic. It's just an absolutely fantastic for it was it's a fantastic issue of a fantastic series. So, before we wrap up and get to the plug, I want you to do. Do you have anything else you want to say about this particular issue or All-Star Squadron the series?
Well, this issue, I listed a bunch of stuff that I love about, but one of the things I didn't mention was how freaking colorful it is. It's just an orgasm of various colors. And I want to tell you that my wife and I have been talking about this. She doesn't consider me colorblind, just color stupid. And her point is that I've read so many comic books in my life that I can't detect nuance in colors. They have to be bright, big, bold superhero colors.
Interesting.
So
Interesting.
I'm looking through this, and this was back. My son has a problem with reading older comics because of the coloring. The coloring is much more nuanced in modern comics, but this, I mean, blue is blue. So Guardian's tunic is the same as Adam's cape and all that. It's glorious. I love
Yeah, oh yeah, I miss all this. Yeah,
it.
I think it's just because that's what I grew up on too. Red is red, yellow is yellow. You know, it's I don't need all these million tones and things like that, and all these muddy colors or whatever. Let's not even get into that image of Superman. They put published for the movie. Again, it's just an absolutely great comic. It's a great mountain comic. So Chuck, thank you so much for coming on to talk with me about it. Now, again, before we wrap up here, the last time we recorded together, it was an episode of, what did we, was it Treasury Cast? Was that the last thing we did together?
It was Super Friends.
Oh, Super Friends. That's right. We were one of the last episodes of For All Mankind. You were not a podcaster then, but you are now. So why don't you tell people about that?
Well, I've always avoided trying to do my own podcast. I've always felt like everybody else has it covered. So what could I possibly have to offer? But I have some friends that are deep into music, and I love orchestral movie soundtracks, especially for superhero movies or science fiction movies. So we've recently started a podcast with Dr. Bob and Dr. Husband. Both have doctorates in music. So I don't know anything. I can't even sing, but I bring the passion. So we'll talk about an orchestral movie soundtrack, and they can provide some of the technical parts of it, but it's all love. So we're about to release our second episode with Star Trek II.
Oh, great score.
I know. I loved it, and I rave about it. And Dr. Husband actually scoots back and opens the piano and starts tinkling on the piano keys and talking about some of what's going on there. So I find that very interesting, that the technical aspects matching up with the passion that I have for it. Cool. And our next one after that, our third one, will be Back to the Future, which Dr. Bob had never seen.
Wow. Oh, that's really cool. What's the name of the show?
Nerd Orchestra.
Okay. And it's available on any of the normal podcast platforms?
Yep.
Okay.
Spotify and Apple.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we're going to run a podcast promo for it. And so everybody will get to hear a little bit of what Chuck is talking about. It sounds really fun. I mean, I sort of did that on my now ceased Pod Dylan show, is that I couldn't talk about the music part of it. I don't know anything about music. I can't speak to that at all, but I could bring the passion for the work. And then hopefully I loved when I could get a musician on to talk about the actual construction, you know, the notes, the tune itself. That was always exciting. So that's cool that you have a nice combination of, you just love the theme to Star Trek, you know, the music in Star Trek II, but you can talk about have somebody on to talk about the actual musicianship of it. That's a good combo.
Yeah. We were talking about Star Trek II, and Dr. Husband mentioned that's a nautical theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I had never heard that, but Star Trek II is a submarine movie. Mm-hmm. He had never thought about that. It's neat little stuff you find out with him.
Very cool. I hope that I am not to blame for you now becoming a podcaster, because I don't want to cause trouble in the marriage. I don't want your wife to be like, oh my God, what is he podcasting for? Because we've done a lot of the Fire and Water Network has been, you know, there's that line about the Velvet Underground, where it was like the Velvet Underground, like nobody bought their records, but everyone that did became a musician. I feel like the Fire and Water Podcast Network has spawned a lot of podcasters, and I'm just hoping that hasn't ruined a lot of potential marriages, but you know.
Well, you guys do good stuff. I love the network.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck. Again, thanks so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. You've been waiting a long time to get to this, because we talked about doing this, like, I think like last year at the end of last season. So thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right. So, of course, everybody, stay tuned. As I promised, and I just like I did last year, I'm going to we're going to take a break. As I mentioned, we're going to run some podcast promos. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback for all the episodes from last season. So stay tuned.
Do you love the music of the movies? Do you exercise to the orchestral soundtracks of movies?
Do you sit in your sanctuary and read comics while the swells of the Superman theme play in the background? Well, so do I. My name is Chuck Dill, and I'm the host of Nerd Orchestra, the podcast that takes a look at the soundtracks accompanying genre films, both past and present. Superman, Star Trek, Back to the Future, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Rocketeer, Jaws, Stargate, Black Hole, Aliens, and many, many more. From such composers as John Williams, James Horner, Danny Elfman, John Barry, Jerry Goldsmith, Michael Giacchino, Alan Silvestri, Christopher Beck, Daniel Pemberton, Henry Jackman, and more. My only credentials for this are a lifelong love of orchestral movie soundtracks. So thankfully, I'm joined by Dr. Bob and Dr. Husband of the Checkered Past podcast. They both have doctorates in music and share the love of genre movies. They are more than capable of providing a technical thought or two towards the music that we review. So please join us as we take a look at some movie favorites through the eyes of our ears.
According to the latest report from falsifiedstats.com, 2.3 million new comic book podcasts are being created every single day. If you're looking for something a little different, then let me tell you about Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow. Mike travels the globe and visits comic shops along the way, like Murfreesboro, Illinois, and Liverpool, New South Wales, Australia. So check out Mike's Comic Shop Roadshow, a truly unique comic book podcast among billions of the same old, same old.
And now it's time for listener feedback. And as promised, these are the comments we got on last season's episodes of Mountain Comics on our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. I wish that there was the time to read all the comments that come in during the season because I deeply, deeply appreciate them. But Mountain Comics, thankfully, gets a lot of comments in relative position to probably how many people actually listen to it. If I read all the comments that came in just last season over the six episodes, this segment would be like 2 hours long. So I'm going to pick a few from each episode, but I'm going to mention every single person that left a comment because, like I said, I deeply appreciate it. And I want you all to know that I am certainly reading every comment and going through them as the season rolls on. So I really, really appreciate all the interest that Mountain Comics generated last season. So, okay, let's get started with episode 41, where I talked about the daring new adventures of Supergirl number 1 plus Supergirl number 13 with my guest, big time comics pro Paul Kupperberg. I get comments from Chuck Coletta, Martin Gray, Paul Ken, David Clancy, Edo Bosnar, Mike Dinas, Bucky749, Michael Ridge, Siskoid, Matt Royce, who says, it may be an unseasonably cool 46 degrees in Massachusetts this morning, but it feels like summer because Mountain Comics is back. Although I think I'll trade the Yoo-Hoo for a hot chocolate. Mr. Kupperberg was a charming and entertaining guest. It's always wonderful when the people we like and admire are terrific people. I was only 9 years old when this comic was on the racks. I didn't read Supergirl. I was afraid of getting cooties. A few short years later, I began seeing Helen Slater in her Supergirl costume, and suddenly cooties seemed worth the risk. Fortunately, as an adult, I can go back and read these stories either in trade collections or out of the back issue bins. All I fear now is my knee popping out when I get up from the chair. Thanks for another entertaining trip back to Nostalgia Land. I look forward to listening to the rest of the season. Thank you so much, Matt. Brian Chufo says, I only recently had discovered Supergirl in the final four issues of Superman Family. The Master Jailer will always be Supergirl's arch nemesis in my brain. Those stories and images are forever burned into my skull. I know I bought every issue of Supergirl, of this Supergirl series, so I must have enjoyed them at the time. But other than her new costume being introduced, I don't remember anything about it. Except the headband. I'm probably in the minority, but I feel like it added a nice balance of color, and it definitely anchors this version of Supergirl in the timeline. When you see that headband, you know it's just before Crisis. Parentheses, Q waves of nostalgia. Dr. Ann says, great discussion on two great issues. For me, I've always been fascinated by the ease with which Supergirl was rebooted with DNAOS number 1. She graduated college in the early 70s and by this point had a career as part of a mobile news team, a guidance counselor, and a soap star. If I recall, Martin Pascal made her a soap star because he was starting to dabble in TV writing and so did Write What You Know change. So Paul was putting her back in school and younger by doing it is just as crazy. Can you imagine the internet response to a soft reboot today? There'd be probably a lot of death threats. As for those first couple of pages in number 13, they were part of the DC sample you have covered here, Rob. Those pages were a primer to get new readers there, or probably a nice recap for new readers brought in by the new logo and new costume. Wonderful discussion on the topic. And spoiler alert, Black Star turns out to be Mrs. Berkowitz's daughter. Dun, dun, dun. Thanks for covering these issues, Rob and Paul. Love the series. Brett Young says, break out the tire swing. Mountain Comics is back. Where are my floaties and neon collared sunglasses? By the way, aren't you contractually obligated to have Dr. Ange on any podcast about Supergirl? To which I replied, I got a special exemption. Ange used his pad and everything. Yeah, I did feel a little bad about not booking Ange for that show. And in fact, after I booked Paul, I wrote to Ange privately and sort of apologized ahead of time, just saying, of course, I would normally have you want to talk Supergirl, but this was a special case because, again, I had Paul talking about the stuff that he, the issues that he wrote. And as you know, anyone who listens to the show with any regularity knows, I try to have one episode per season where I book a comics pro, and that was my episode. And so, again, apologies to Ange, and you give me from the comments, as always, use the gentleman about it. Next up, the comments to episode 42, Raiders of the Lost Ark number 3, with my guest Henry Bernstein. Got comments from Captain Entropy, Chuck Coletta, Matt Zeroyce, Alexander M. Osias, Brett Young, Bucky749, Santoron Siskoid, Ado Buznar, who says, since the bulk of your discussion was about the new movie and the whole Indiana Jones franchise, I'll just say that with the exception of a few issues of the Marvel Comics series, I'm not really a big fan of any post-Raiders indie content in any media. That's right, not the biggest fan of any of the follow-up movies, nor the Young Indie TV series, or anything else. Given what made the first movie so much fun, including its excellent last scene, I think everything made after that should have basically been the adventures of Indy and Marion. As to the main topic of the show, i.e. the comics adaptation of Raiders, I really enjoyed the discussion. I had the complete series back then, and I liked it well enough, although I think I enjoyed the art more than anything else. The Buscema-Jansen combination on the art was indeed really effective. I agree that the way the dialogue was written seemed off at times and lacked much of the film's charm and humor, so I tend to agree with Rob that perhaps Simonson was working off a preliminary script. Yeah, Ado, as we talked about, I think maybe on that episode, or maybe we talked about it more on the episode of Fade Out on Dial of Destiny that Henry and I did, I love Raiders so completely, and none of them, to me, not any piece of indie content after that has gotten anywhere close to being that good. And sometimes I started to wonder, am I just a fan of Raiders? And then it was actually Dial of Destiny that brought me back and say, no, it really is indie. It's just Raiders is just a lightning in a bottle kind of experience. And the other films, the other content have things to recommend them, some things not to. But, you know, I'm okay with the idea that it's just Raiders is Raiders. And it's just, you know, the fact that it's they've never been able to match it is like, well, you know, like winning the lottery twice kind of. So. Andrew Leyland says, you know, when you listen to a podcast and feel seen, that was this. Like Rob, I felt the main problem with KOTCS was that Spielberg seems to have forgotten how to make an Indiana Jones film. Having liked James Mangold's film, I welcomed a fresh eye. I enjoyed the movie until the last 30 minutes when I was on the edge of my seat. Like Rob, I couldn't believe they'd done it, but more importantly, how the hell would they get out of it? I loved how the message of time was woven through the film until it became literally what the film was about. Like Star Trek II, it approached the aging of the character and dealt with it head on. This was a great lesson, and Henry was a great guest. Marion was spoiled for me as well, but it was my own fault for listening to the score before seeing the film. The death of Qui-Gon. I also agree about Star Wars. I liked The Last Jedi for taking a big swing, but overall I'd sacrifice it for a sequel trilogy that made any damn sense. Mike Dinah says, that was a fantastic episode, gentlemen. Just listening to you talk about this one comic in particular and then the movies in general gave me the same feeling I had when watching Raiders for the first time. Wow. It was such a fun thrill ride of a movie that I couldn't turn away. But for me, I would say Crusade is the better movie over Raiders. But that's like saying this genius piece of art is slightly better than that genius work of art. They're both great. For Dial of Destiny, without putting any spoilers here, I would agree with Rob and say that it's the fourth or perhaps tied for third best Indiana Jones movie. But I feel like that's saying it was bad when I don't think it is at all. It's a good movie and had some fun moments, but it doesn't capture that awe that I got from Raiders and Crusade. And of course, the message of time in this movie hits closer to home the older I get. As for the Raiders comic in particular, I never got the movie adaptation as a kid, but I did manage to snag a run of issues 1 of 8 of The Further Adventures of Indiana Jones from my local comic store after hearing Rob and Dr. Ange talk about them a while ago. 2 years ago? 3 years ago? Geez, FW Presents from March 2018. And to me, this is the perfect way to continue the adventures. While the movies are fun, I feel like returning Jones to his roots in the pulp magazines is where these further adventures really shine. That and the novels came out in the 90s, 2000s. These are great tales that capture all the pulpy goodness of what Indiana Jones is based on, and you can have an unlimited FX budget and actors who don't age. Well done. Again, on a great show, keep up the great work. Thank you, Mike. Episode 43, Marvel 2-in-1, number 81, with my guest Brett Young. Got comments from Rob McCarthy, Brian Schufo, Siskoid, Matt Zeroyce, Gene Hendricks, Captain Entropy, Bucky 749, And Ada Bosnori says, I really enjoyed the meandering conversation around this issue. It was really like a chat on the porch of a cabin in the mountains. And I remember having this issue as I was a pretty regular reader of Marvel 2-in-1 at this point. However, the part that sticks in my memory the most is that excellent scene at the beginning when Namor goes shopping. He was so hilariously overbearing. I love the bit where one of the clerks says something about getting the manager when he makes his grand entrance, to which he replies, see that you do. On the question of subscriptions, interesting that you picked Kazar, Rob, because I have to inform you that, yes, I indeed had a subscription. I used to love that series and hated that it did not always appear on the spinner racks in my neck of the woods. Once it went direct market only, I felt compelled to subscribe. And yes, to back up what Brett said, they did arrive in pretty good condition inside a brown paper wrapper, but usually folded in half. Oh, man. By the way, the Bill Foster subplot, which became the main plot, played out over the next 4 or 5 issues. And I should note that at this point, ever since the Project Pegasus saga began, Bill was going by the name Giant Man, not Black Goliath. Thank you for the note. I didn't know that. Brett Young, the guest of this very episode, said, great show, Rob and me. Just a magnificent back and forth, like Frost Nixon with Yoo-Hoo. Speaking of which, I tried a squeeze box of Yoo-Hoo with a shot of Bailey's and blended it with a few ice cubes. It's an awesome. Why can't I say that? It's an awesome, frothy nightcap for enjoying in the back porch as the sun goes down over the lake. Okay, I better get this Columbia 10-speed out of sight before the heat catches up with me. Thanks again for having me on the show. It was a blast. See you next time. Thank you, Brett. And then finally, Devin Clancy says, I once heard someone describe Yoo-Hoo as the runoff in the street outside of a Carvel factory. Oh, that is simultaneously brutal and fair. Episode 44, Batman number 365, with my guest Terry O'Malley, got comments from Matt Royce, Brian Chufo, Rob McCarthy, Robert J. Smith, Ange, Chris Franklin. Ada Bosnori says, oh man, what a great show. I have to admit that my favorite part was Terry's recollections of his adventures in comics reading. I also like that his decision to start actually collecting regularly reading comics was sparked by Ragman number 1. I've always had a soft spot for the original Ragman ever since I picked up the whole whopping 5-issue run for a song sometime in 1981. This issue came after the point when I was only occasionally picking up Batman comics, which I now regret because I absolutely love Newton's art. I recall having a few issues of Detective from a few years earlier with his work and loved it. He was such a perfect fit for Batman in particular. True that. Ian Fletcher says, great episode, Rob and Terry. I could almost smell the old wooden floor as Terry recounted his experience. He is a great storyteller. I laughed aloud when Terry admitted that some of these farm comics were likely burnt in the fire. Was this the kids being a firebug or the adults not really caring about those funny books? Maybe a bit of both. Bonus points for mixing in the love of an issue and the nostalgia of reading away from home experience with an earnest, frustrated fan rant are the direction a book went in a certain era. And I'm going to agree with Terry. This plot makes no sense. I might not have picked up on that when I was a kid. I was 7 when this issue hit the newsstands. But this does feel typical to the Joker as a master planner shtick. They began to trying to add the character over time. I have similar complaints about Joker's scheme in the Dark Knight film, but now I feel like I'm getting sidetracked. Rob, this is generally one of my favorite shows on the network, just a wholesome walk down memory lane, looking at a great bygone era of life and comics. Well, thank you, Ian. I really do appreciate that. And regarding episode 45, Superman Family number 192 with my guest Sean M. Myers, got comments from Matt Royce, Isamu Hideki Yuginori, Martin Gray, Captain Entropy, Brian Chufo, Bucky749, Rob, Ada Bosnar, Bradley Glynn, Brett Young, Paul Kim, Al Girding, who says, awesome that you covered a Superman family. Loved every part of this issue as a kid and still do. The Jimmy/Speedy story sort of connects to all my all-time favorite Teen Titans issue, number 44. Nightwing and Flamebird segments and later Mr. Mrs. stories have always been some of my best memories of this title. By the way, Don L. was another cousin of Superman's. So many L's. Dr. Ange says, great episode and great host chemistry. I'm a big Superman family fan. I felt like this book is really what cemented my love of Supergirl, even if her stories here in retrospect aren't the strongest. I definitely like the breadth of the family. Like Sean, I love the Mr. and Mrs. Superman stories. Unlike Sean, I like Nightwing and Flamebird. Some of the stories have very early Marshall Rogers art, which is breathtaking. And this is full-on Mr. Action Jimmy Olsen. Sean's story about Superman family number 200 was amusing. I knew by the date when Action Comics number 500 was coming out. That day, I walked down the street to the 7-Eleven at 2 p.m., 3 p.m., 4 p.m. waiting for them to open up the new comics and put them out. Are the new comics out? Finally, when I walked down at 5 p.m., the guy behind the counter who had been dealing with me all day said, exasperated, what is the comic you're looking for, kid? I explained it was Action and it had that pink cover. I knew it from the ad which provided the date info. He went to the back of the store and came out with the copy to give me. Hope you got more Superman family in the mountains. What a great story, Ange. I just, I love stuff like that. You know, it just annoyed newsstand vendors who went the extra mile to make the 75 cents or a dollar it took to sell that Action Comics. That's great. By the way, everybody, if you have stories like that, please share them in the comments. And I promise I will do my best to get to them, at some other point in Mount. Maybe if we have enough of them, I can even do like a special bonus segment just relating those stories, because I just am so utterly charmed by the stories of getting comics back in the newsstand days. And of course, that's kind of what the show is all about. Chris Franklin, of course, from this very network, says, "Great show, guys. I had this issue, and it's probably my earliest issue of the title. I think this is the first time I met Speedy, the Guardian, Crypto, and maybe even the notion of Superboy. I'm with you guys. I prefer my Superman not being Superboy, but yet I sure bought a lot of New Adventures of Superboy comics as a kid. I guess in modern pop culture, it's a bit of a Young Sheldon-like retcon. It's also funny that what Rob describes as preferring a costume Superboy is essentially the TV series Smallville. There's 10 seasons of that, Rob. Go binge it." Good point, Chris. I think I tapped out around season 7, I think, at that point. I don't know. I know I watch all the ones with Aquaman. I think the Crypto logo was basically the same font, style, and design as the classic Superboy logo, which was used on his regular title for years, and then the modified for the New Adventures of Superboy series. I believe it was designed by Iris Knapp. Probably. Genius, that guy. "Is it wrong that I was unsure if the Human Cannonball was wearing a helmet or had an afro? It was the 70s after all. Thankfully, Isamu's wonderful Who's Who page cleared that up for me. I always enjoyed Superman Family, but when they added my favorite strip, Mr. and Mrs. Superman, that became the reason I bought it practically every month." Very cool. And then the final episode of last season, episode 46, Green Lantern numbers 175 and 194, with my guest, Dr. Chris Lewis, got comments from Ado Bosnar, Martin Gray, Brian Chufo, Matt Sarois, Ange, Bradley Glynn, Siskoid, Noah Tarnow, who says, "Great conversation. It's funny, as a small child, I declared Green Lantern my favorite superhero." I declared, simply because I liked his costume and his powers. But it wasn't until I bought GL number 175 with the stands that I can recall actually enjoying a GL story. I remember finding the shark genuinely terrifying, which is indeed a testament to Ween and Gibbons' skill. I think a lot of the early Crisis crossovers don't work because, in my mind, it seems like Wolfman or DC Editorial or whoever wasn't yet sure what the story would be about other than the supposedly necessary Universal reboot. Read some of the GL issues between these two comics. You have the Monitor as a mysterious figure ensconced in his satellite, trafficking weaponry to the demolition team of all people. Similar subplots took place in a ton of DC titles. For some reason, the Monitor seemed invested in the success of the Mortiest of Morts, and I still don't know why. There's no doubt that the Crisis crossover mandate wasn't a good fit for much of the company line, if any of it. Yeah, I mean, good Lord, you could do a whole podcast series. They probably have done them. About, you know, the ins and outs of Crisis. I remember, you know, when the Monitor would show up in like Saga of the Swamp Thing as drawn by Bissett and Tottleman, and was like, what are we doing here? You know, it feels so strange. So, or even like, did he show up in the Western, not the Western titles? I think did he show up in GI Combat, I think, or something? I don't know. Yeah. Some of those crossovers were a little on the dodgy side. Paul Kien from, of course, This Very Network says, "Great episode to finish the season. You've inspired me to reread those great Ween Gibbon GLs. You're welcome to borrow mine, Rob, but you'll have to wait until I'm done." I never heard back from you, Paul. And then, of course, Chris Franklin says, "Great show, fellas. I was very excited by the Ween Gibbons run on GL. The house ads really grabbed me, but unfortunately, the dreaded newsstand was a cruel mistress, and I missed a lot of issues. For instance, I got this issue, but missed the next, so I guess I assumed Hal was brain dead for months. I will agree with the other folks up above that Crisis coordination was a mess. Marv really had no idea who the Monitor was or what his plan was before issue number one of Crisis hit. So I can't imagine how the other creators felt. John wearing his mask is definitely a retcon, catching up to the events previously seen in the first few issues of Crisis. Waiting for the announcement of Chris's Truck Stop Comics on the network." I would totally co-sign for that show. So, Chris, you listening? Get on this. And then finally, Captain Entropy says, "Nothing really to add but to affirm, 80s GL good. This season of Mountain Comics good. Dr. Chris Lewis and Rob Kelly always good. That is all." Well, thank you, Captain. So again, thanks everybody for the comments. I really do appreciate it. And I always try every season opener to read as many of them as I can to keep this segment, you know, manageable, but also, you know, a decent sampling of what all you wrote, because I love reading these comments. They're super fun. And I really thank you all for listening. And so, of course, big thanks to Chuck Dill for coming to the cabin. sharing some Yoo-Hoo with me and talking about this super awesome issue of All-Star Squadron and kicking off this season of Mount Comics. We have some fun stuff planned. I hope you stick around. We will see you soon. Of course, you can subscribe to the show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can follow all the back episodes on the website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can also find the show over on Twitter at FWPMountainCom. So that is going to do it. Thanks so much, and we will see you next month. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos. Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Have every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and...
Beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.